2005. Sounds like all the members of the committee are in a good mood, so you better bring your bills up as quick as you can so we can get through our agenda, and you'll be smooth sailing from here. Colleagues, we're going to plow through this agenda today. The first bill, House Bill 3049, is a bill that we're bringing back because we really did not have an opportunity to explore that issue fully, but I think it's a very important issue, the issue of offsets and what persons with disabilities receive from I think their SSI and where that places them in their eligibility for other resources. Sometimes, in fact, they are penalized for that assistance. So we're going to bring up the first panel on 3049. They'll explain it to us. So, Brian Glassman, bring whoever you're going to bring. And I see Norm and I see Catherine. Okay.
Just as a footnote, while the folks are getting settled, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
But it's a mighty good bill, if I might say so.
Good morning. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian DeLeishman. I'm here representing the Community Providers Association of Oregon. They are a organization of residential homes for DD and MED clients. I'm going to be very brief because the experts are sitting next to me, and I've spoken to many of you about this particular bill, and it did have a hearing, and unfortunately you were all on the floor, and Representative Dolko was here along with staff. And as they were given examples of people with these disabilities and their work, I think both the chair and the committee assistant was stunned to realize that these people work a number of hours and in essence are penalized for working. And we have decided that this obviously is a very important issue for our clients. We think it's an important issue for the state. We do not want to disincentivize any client groups in this state from working when they can work with dignity, they can earn income, they can pay taxes, and they can have some money at the end of the month in which they can buy toothpaste and toothbrushes, because in essence they're getting money taken away from them and they cannot even afford those. And with that, I'll turn it over to Norm.
Can we, before we get into this, explain who these people are so that everybody in the committee knows in the course of your presentation, please, Norm?
Sure.
Good morning.
My name is Norm Kohler, and I have submitted written testimony, so you should have in front of you two pages. The first page explains who I am and tries to summarize in a nutshell a fairly complicated issue. The second page is merely a case study of a real live individual, and I tried to keep his case to one page, and it's a particularly trying example for me since I've worked with this individual for the last 11 years. But I'm Norm Kohler, Executive Director of Community Access Services. My company works with individuals with developmental disabilities in Washington, Clackamas, Multnomah, and Columbia counties. And I've been there for 16 years, and I've been here a number of times on the same issue, which seems to slide by us for some reason. Let me give a little background, and I'm not going to read the page I gave you, but let me just talk to that and hopefully clarify some of the issues. Individuals in the state of Oregon in Medicaid-funded services have to be Medicaid eligible. That means they have to have a certified disability, and they are supported in one of two ways through federal Medicaid funds. They can either be on SSI, which is the payer of last resort, or they can be on SSDI. The difference is that if anyone's eligible for any other benefits, they take precedence over SSI. SSI is kind of the minimum amount of disability to survive. SSDI, for most of our clients, comes through their parents' work record, as they, as a disabled child, are eligible for lifetime support. The offset system is an offset refers to an amount of money that's taken from them to offset for the pay for the care of their services. And we think rightly so, since they're in sometimes very costly services because of their disability. We have a kind of a two-part system here that we're trying to rectify. Namely, that if the person on SSI has earned income over $65, their SSI is adjusted downward $1 for every $2 they make. So there is a work incentive for those individuals on SSI. If they're on SSDI, however, Social Security Disability Insurance, it doesn't work that way. They're allowed to keep the first $65 of their pay, and the amount over $65 goes into the offset, the entire amount. And one of the egregious problems with this is that they are required, unless they're working for a company that is exempt from Social Security tax, they are required to pay, as we all do, the 7.65% of their income for Social Security and Medicare tax on their entire gross income. So when I refer you to the second page of my handout, the case of Allen, I used his figures for 2003 because I'd already put them together rather than 2004, and we just filed his taxes for 2004. Here's a case of a person whose take-home pay was less than nothing. In other words, he had to pay to work. At the end of each month, and you see that Allen's average monthly income at DePaul Industries for 2003 was $710. And he, in state income tax and Medicare and Social Security tax on his income, paid in excess of the $65 he was allowed to keep from the $710 each month. And it simply impoverished him. It's sort of our version of the indentured servant. Allen can do very little. He has very little money. His average offset payment was $1,338 a month. The room and board payment that you see there is the standard room and board payment for all clients and services. That is, the room and board cost that goes back to the provider providing care for the client is set by the state. It's the same for all folks, and it comes out of their unearned income. So the folks we serve have two sources of income, or two potential sources of income. They have unearned income, which is either SSI or SSDI. The offset essentially takes the excess of the SSDI and reduces it to the SSI amount. So the effect of a parent working a lifetime for their disabled child is negated if that child is in services. The person on SSI only pays the room and board and other associated costs out of their SSI, but they are not subject to the offset unless they have earned income.
I'm going to ask you a question since the chair isn't here. Why doesn't he then go under SSI instead of SSDI?
SSI is the payer of last resort. SSI pays only when someone is not eligible for any other benefits.
Okay.
So when we evaluate a person for services, if they're eligible for veterans benefits, for railroad benefits, for Social Security through their parents' working life, that takes precedent over SSI. If that's a very small amount, then SSI sometimes pays something.
Thank you.
So SSI is kind of the safety net payment.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Norm, I'm interested, is this offset, does it, presently it's under state statute, does it run amok of any federal law if we are to modify this?
You know, I sure hope so. And what I'm saying is I hope that some part of this is illegal. Not in terms of what we're doing. My personal opinion, and I'm getting too old to care what people think about me, is that this is a disgrace for people in the state of Oregon, and it's gone on far too long.
Representative Butler, if I may, it's my understanding that other states, all states, don't handle it the same way. So I believe there's flexibility within the federal administrative rules and the federal statutes to handle it in a way that is more like what we're proposing here. But part of this bill actually is to ask the state if they need a waiver at the federal level to seek a waiver to be able to do that.
Madam Chair, that's exactly what I was concerned about, was that we would need to have this a waiver actually sought in order to do what it is that we're attempting to do, because what we're trying to modify how much can be held back under a program or federal program.
Right.
I can respond to that briefly. I sought the help of the National Advocacy Group last year, and they pointed me to a number of states that have a different arrangement than we have, including Kentucky, Minnesota, Utah. And in talking to them, people I talked to were flabbergasted that Oregon treated some of its disabled citizens in this manner.
Thank you. Want to continue?
Okay. What we're hoping, at the very least, is that those individuals on SSDI be afforded the same work incentive of people on SSI. And this is a budget item. This has an impact on the state. The impact, I submit, is not easy to determine. What I understand is that there's something like $700,000 that comes back to the state for state services for folks who pay an offset on their earned income. If they were given a work incentive, that would be immediately cut in half if the incentive were 50%, as we're suggesting. And then there would be, and I don't have figures on this, there would be people who would begin working again who are very able to work but who refuse to work. And as I talked to providers, I was given example after example of individuals who refuse to work because they understand enough to know that they're not paid for their work.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon DD Coalition, which includes 26 groups representing individuals with disabilities, providers, and family members. We are in strong support of this piece of legislation. This is an issue that was brought before the legislature a number of legislative sessions before, and we feel it is something that we would strongly urge you to forward on to Ways and Means to become a part of the agency discussion. We know that there are other states that have addressed this. The Oregon offset systems traps people with developmental disabilities into a cycle of poverty and dependence. We know examples of individuals who allowed to keep percentages of their earned income could move themselves out of more restrictive and more costly environments and could begin to work toward greater independence in their services and less costly services. So we really urge you to pass this bill and move it to Ways and Means. There are, as Norm mentioned, other states that have addressed this issue. There are people in Oregon that could help us through that process, and we're very willing to work with the agency to make something happen. And we recognize that there's some fiscal impact, but we also recognize that there is a certain fiscal impact in the amount of work that the providers are being asked to do in terms of monitoring the money, taking the money, maintaining the paperwork, and moving it into the state system. So there are hidden costs here that don't necessarily are not necessarily reflected in the state estimate in terms of the cost of making some modifications in this. So thank you.
If
if I may, Mr. Chair, just in summary, actually the way the bill is drafted right now, you actually see a blank on there. What we're asking, the way it was drafted, is above the $65 and then between the $65 and whatever you fill in the blank, and obviously that could be done in ways and means. As Norm had indicated, and we also had contemplated, and another way to do this is to, above the $65 offset cap, to say that the client can keep half or keep some percentage of that, so there's still an incentive to work, but there's no upward limits on the amount that they can earn. Therefore, you still don't have that disincentive that once they get to the upper limits, then they all of a sudden decide, well, I don't need to work anymore because I'm not going to capture anything. So there's several ways to do this. This is just one drafting style. But we would encourage you to move this to Ways and Means so it can be part of the discussion in the department's budget there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Additional questions or comments? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give us an illustration from the two that you've given us on income and required expenses, what it would be like if they were on SDI instead of SSDI? Is there a comparison? How much would they'd be paying nothing, they'd be paying $1,000, they'd be paying $1,200?
On the front page of my testimony, the last paragraph, I tried to contrast two individuals doing the same work, same number of hours at the same wage. And what I've indicated here is that an individual's SSI is reduced by $1 for each $2 he or she earns over $65 in a month. And in effect, a person earning $265 on SSI would get to keep $265, the amount they earned. Their SSI would in turn be reduced by half of their earnings over $65. It would be reduced by $100. The person on SSDI with the same paycheck in hand would allegedly get to keep the first $65 that they made. They would pay the Medicare and Social Security tax on the entire $265. Everything over the first $65 would go back into their offset. And an example of that is the individual on the second page, where I've given you his total income and what he pays in the offset. And then after he's paid his taxes, again, an egregious case of double taxation in my view, he keeps pennies on the dollar or less. Alan, for example, had to pay more than he earned.
So essentially they continue to pay their offset, but they would pay less on the 265 or whatever they do earn.
Yeah. What we're proposing is that if the individual can keep half of what they make over $65, the other half would go into the offset.
Okay, but they would keep much more of what they earn.
But again, there is no work incentive. And to give you a real life example, I met with a person who lives in Alloa in Washington County. And the people who work with him say he refuses to work. Sometimes he'll work the first one or two days of the month. And he says, "You don't pay me, why should I work?" He's purchased a lawnmower and a weed eater, and he goes about the neighborhood asking for work from people, and he gets some. But they have to pay him cash. He has to see the cash in his hand, or he simply goes back to his apartment to play video games.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
I'm wondering, in this regard, if Norm, and it probably could be amended in this committee before it was sent to Ways and Means, but if we had a simple revision on it, that we were dealing only with net compensation, that is the net compensation after the withholdings for FICA and the Medicare and state income taxes and those kinds of things, that would be one way where there would not be the monthly penalty of the withholding relative to state income tax and Social Security and Medicare tax. And if we were to amend this bill, provide that we were only dealing with the net amounts that they were receiving, not as to the gross, because they're being penalized because of the gross, then that would give that would give even a smaller fiscal impact, I would think, when it got to the Ways and Means process.
Well, it would for people who make $65 a month, or say under $100 a month, for someone like Alan who makes $700.10 a month to keep $65 without. He would be $65 a month better off than he is now. It wouldn't solve his problems. It would solve them a little bit, and it would be helpful. But it wouldn't be much of a work incentive for most of the people that I know.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Okay, thanks very much.
Yeah, that's right.
I work, they make less. I make now. They figure that out. Some of them work anyway. How many more would you get? I think they're not working. It's just sort of being more careless.
Okay. Is it Deanna Hardwick? Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deanna Hardwick.
I guess we need a microphone. Thanks. You don't need to talk directly.
Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Deanna Hardwick with the Department of Human Services, Senior and People with Disabilities. While we support the intent of this bill, I am here to testify in opposition because the associated costs are not in the governor's recommended budget. As you have heard, this bill would ask the department to discontinue collecting offsets for people who are working, living in residential services, and contributing towards the cost of their care. As you've been told, the current practice is to disregard the first $65 of their earnings and apply everything else towards the cost of care. There are approximately 600 individuals who are working and earning more than $65 living in residential settings. Approximately $28,000 per month has been collected for the offset contribution. For a biennial amount, that would be about $695,000. The proposals in this bill also conflict with some federal regulations, which are specific regarding the treatment of earnings. So any offset that we would not collect, the state would have to pick up that cost at pure general fund dollars. It is a requirement for the individual served under the home and community-based waiver, which the majority of people with developmental disabilities living in residential settings are covered under, to contribute towards the cost of care.
You ask a question?
Yes, to me.
Ms. Hartwig, are you familiar with some of the testimony that we just heard about some states, Kentucky, Utah, and Minnesota, getting federal waivers? And if so, what would that process be?
I am not familiar with whether they sought federal waivers or had some other mechanism for adjusting the cost of care requirement. I'd be very interested in getting names from those states so we could discuss it with them. It would require a modification of our current waiver with the federal government around community-based services for people with developmental disabilities if we were no longer going to collect the offset in the way that we have told them that they are and the way the state practice has been for many, many years. So, yes, it would require a federal waiver.
And could you please, when you do find that information, would you please give it to me and probably the rest of the committee?
Representative Tomei, Chair Dalto, members of the committee, absolutely would be happy to send that information over.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Yes. Thank you for being here this morning. Maybe I should ask this to the previous group that was up, but do you have any idea if we were to incentivize where people can keep half of every dollar they earn, how many people out there might work that aren't working today? Do you have a...
Representative Cameron, members of the committee, I don't. I think the Provider Association, because they are the ones who see the people on a daily basis, would have a better idea of that than we at the state level. We get information about what the unearned income is, what the earnings are, and we calculate the contribution. We don't know who isn't working because of that or any other particular circumstance but affect their decision or not.
Well, so the dollars here that are assessed would be strictly on the dollars that we would lose on the people that are working today. There's been no background or research done on the dollars we would pick up that we would gain from the people who might go to work, and we'd get some of those dollars back.
Representative Cameron, that is correct. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I'd like to ask two questions. First of all, for Representative Butler, how many people in a normal CPA practice?
In a normal CPA practice? CPAs aren't normal.
Small, if you could find one.
A small CPA practice in a small town firm, probably 10 staff, support staff. With
how many clients?
Oh, with clients? Probably 200 clients per CPA, 200 to 300 clients per CPA, depending upon the scope and nature of the work performed.
Seems interesting to me that we could spend $695,000 just to adjust our computer system. No. Might be...
$695,000, they are said plus money to adjust the computer system.
Okay, Mr. Redman. What I was thinking was it'd almost be cost-effective to just hire one or two private CPAs to handle all of these problems. But $695,000 to cover a $28,000 cost.
Yeah, can you explain to us how with this $695,000 number arrives, and what the significance of this statement, the monthly offset generated to reduce the cost of residential services, is $28,975 per month. What does that mean?
Representative Dalto, that current $28,975 per month is what we currently collect from individuals who are working and earning more than $65 a month. We took that $28,000 that we currently collect in offsets, times it by 24 to get a biennial figure.
So 28.9 times 24 is 695?
Yep. Probably. I hope so. I didn't just math on this one. I didn't double check my calculator.
30,000 times 24 would be
625.
Okay. And they may throw in someone that ones have expense for the computer adjustment.
Okay. Well. All right. So where does that 28,000 per month go then? You're collecting that.
It reduces the cost that the state and federal government pay for the cost of services. So for every dollar that we collect in an offset, that reduces the total service payment. Say the service payment was $1,000. We collected $300 in offset. The remaining $700 would be shared with the state and federal funds, approximately 40% for the state, 60% for the feds.
So $695,000 to adjust this inequity for a group of people who have been unequal for all their lives in the scope of a more than $2 billion general funds budget. That's what you're telling me. This is like...
Yeah, and only 40% of that would be state funds, right?
And only 40% of that would be state funds.
Representative Dalto, Representative Greenleaf, that's not correct.
Oh,
because the federal government, as the condition of granting a waiver, has a requirement that individuals contribute towards the cost of care, would not share in this cost because the client contribution is used to reduce the federal portion as well as the state portion. So if we are required by federal regulations in that waiver to collect the offset, and we don't, I don't believe they're going to agree to participate in an extra cost that they would not otherwise incur. So to answer one of your questions about getting a waiver, we would have to seek a waiver asking them to do just that.
Can we just pay the money ourselves?
Representative Dalto, I believe we could, as long as we paid for it with it. In essence, with general funds, so the federal government had no contribution or responsibility to pay the difference between what we collect and what the cost of service would be.
I have a solution. We'll tax the accountants for it. Representative Cameron.
I just want to make it clear for the record that this $695,000 on a two-year basis is assuming that we would lose every dollar that we're currently recouping on those 600 people, correct?
Representative Cameron, that is correct.
Okay, so the bill hasn't been finalized that we might, it just might be one for two, correct? As in SSI payments, isn't that what we're talking about? So as we're moving this bill forward, that number there is actually double of what it would be?
Representative Cameron, this is based on a full discontinuation of collecting the current offset. So that assumes that every dollar over $65 went back to the individual, and we covered their cost of care contribution with straight general funds. So this is just based on everything over 65, no one for two or two for three or one.
Okay, and I don't believe there's been any testimony to replace the entire amount today in this bill, correct?
Representative Cameron, when we looked at the bill, we noticed that it said in, for amounts over 65, and the upper limitation was blank. So in order to give you an indication of perhaps the worst-case scenario, if you will, we calculated losing all of the client contribution.
That's not a worst-case scenario. That's an excellent-case scenario that people are working on getting to make some money, in my estimation.
Representative Dawson,
God forbid they should be able to make some money
that
and keep it.
Lowest.
All right, Representative Butler, and we got to move on, but Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask Ms. Hartwig relative to the fact that Oregon is under a waiver under this SSDI portion, and do you know of any other states? There have been other states mentioned. I think several states were mentioned. Representative Tomei wrote them down. But the concern I've got is that do you know of any other states that do this only based upon the net that they receive as opposed to the gross? It appears that the largest portion of the inequity is that these folks are being charged based upon the fact that they are earning wages that move over to the Social Security and Medicare systems, or that move to the taxation system, but they do not receive. And there's a fairly significant portion of that is being captured a second time based upon what your testimony is. Any evidence that other states may have gone to a net portion, recapturable portion only?
Representative Butler, members of the committee, I do not know. If Mr. Kohler could provide the names of the individuals that he spoke with in those three states, we'd be happy to contact them and find out if they had a particular waiver, if for some reason their state supplement was higher and that allowed them to do other kinds of things towards client contribution, or if they're actually calculating off a net instead of a gross.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a little uneasy of the potential of adding back to the individuals, because under federal waiver, it may be that when the state adds back, that's considered to be additional income to them, to these same individuals too. So I just am concerned that we probably need additional federal waiver to do what it is that Ms. Hartwig is bringing as a concern. So.
Okay, Representative Boone, and then we'll wrap.
No, I'll pass.
Oh, okay, thanks. Well, thank you very much. And then Michael Cross, is Michael Cross here?
No. Good morning.
Mr. Cross, can I ask you to remove your hat, please?
I was a little surprised there was no flag in here. The reason I'm here...
I need you to introduce yourself before you begin, please.
Sure. Michael Cross.
Thank you.
Okay. The reason I'm here is to talk about the budget that goes to services to children and families. When I looked at it, it was almost $500 million. Is that correct? Or,
you know, Mr. Cross, this isn't a budget committee, nor are we discussing children and families right now. We have a full agenda. Is the children and families what you want to talk about?
Well, it has to do with...
Oh, it's in the wrong room.
Wrong room.
I think you're in the wrong room. Could we have somebody escort you to the budget committee that they're discussing that right now?
Okay. What are we talking about here then?
We're talking about offset payments for people with developmental disabilities that are working.
Okay. Okay. I am wrong.
Annie, could you escort Mr. Cross to next door? He's looking for the Human Services Budget Committee. Yeah. Just take him over to Adam. Thank you. Okay, with that we will, sounds to me like we have a little more work to do on 3049. So we'll do that, and we'll bring this bill back. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3049. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2955. This is the bill that directs the governor to appoint a drug policy coordinator, and I'd invite Representative Greenlick to come forward to introduce this to us. I believe it's his bill. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33. I remembered today. Good. I've been working over the last 6 years with the substance abuse treatment community, trying to bring research and drug treatment together to improve the care of folks and who have substance abuse problems or who may have them. And it's become clear to me over that period that we really don't have a very coordinated approach in this state to the question of substance abuse treatment prevention, introduction of drugs, the correctional system and how it treats folks with substance abuse, the policies in the Department of Education around substance abuse and how schools deal with this question, worksite questions of substance abuse, a whole set of areas in this state. The meth report that came out recently as a result of an ad hoc group looking at the questions for the governor on the methamphetamine epidemic really highlighted this for me with a set of, I think, excellent recommendations. But the recommendations went across the whole board. It talked about how our criminal justice system deals with illicit drugs. It talked about how human services, it talked about prevention, it talked about schools. And when we look to find out who's responsible for implementing the suggestions, in addition to our responsibility for passing some legislation, it turns out there's not a single focal point in the state for dealing with the question of substance abuse. This problem has become so pervasive in our society. We've talked about the meth epidemic in one bill after another here and in certainly again in our subcommittee on child welfare, that it seems to me it's time for us to address this problem seriously. The model that I saw was how we began 4 years ago to deal with Homeland Security, where the governor decided it was necessary to name a specific person for Homeland Security and to bring together a Homeland Security Council of all the components of the state who were involved in preparing us for Homeland Security and for our disaster response questions. That has evolved into a department, and that's an interesting issue, but the fact is our first response to it was to highlight in our state executive branch a very specific focal point for dealing with this problem. This bill, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, does exactly that same thing. It says that this problem is pervasive enough, goes across agencies sufficiently, that it's time to create a single focal point in our executive department to deal with it. And the proposal is to create a substance abuse policy coordinator in the governor's office and to create a council with which that coordinator would meet regularly across a set of agencies. Those agencies include the Department of Corrections, State Police, DHS, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, the Director of the Department of Environmental Quality, the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And the job of that coordinator would be to review all our state policies with that council, all of whom have a piece of the action, to try and come forward with a coordinated effort to reduce substance abuse, to reduce the ravages of the substance abuse in our state. You'll hear some folks testifying from the substance abuse community on this, and it seems to me while this is a first step and a modest first step, it would at least highlight in the executive department this issue and allow an opportunity for the executive department to much more effectively coordinate its work in the substance abuse area. With that, I'll... do you want to answer questions or...
Any questions?
Get off stage and let you take testimony from people who know more about it than I do.
Representative Boone.
Not a question, just another comment about our SAGE colleague and his another good idea.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Should we bring up a panel? Bob Nickel, Tim Hartnett, Gina Furman. You choose who speaks first. It's like no exit.
All right. Members of the committee, Vice Chairs Tomei and Butler, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and I'm here to provide testimony on House Bill 2955. The department is taking a neutral position on this bill. We want to provide you with some information, and I have written testimony that we've prepared that goes into some detail on this. I think what I want to say briefly is that the concept of this bill is a very positive thing. There's no question that the need for coordination and better collaboration is always a key issue. One issue that I think the committee should be aware of is that some, although not all, of the functions that this bill would provide for are also already in statute, and they relate to the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. So one of the questions that we would have about the bill is how that particular set of functions would relate to this particular proposal. I think the other thing that I'd like to point out is that the need for coordination really goes much further beyond state agencies. It really has to do with local coordination, law enforcement, jails, local prevention efforts, county mental health and addictions issues. So I think at the state level, at this point, functionally, we've been working very hard to provide these kind of coordinating functions through the governor's office and the governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Program. So I think that would summarize my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Nickel? Thank you. Gina?
Committee members and co-chairs, Representative Tomei and Representative Butler. First of all, my name is Gina Furman. I am the director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And we want to go on record saying that we are very supportive of the concept of this bill. I think that one of the problems that we've been facing in Oregon is we don't have one point of contact or one vocal drug coordinator, although I do believe that most of these functions in this bill are being done currently by the governor's office or at OMAS or in the governor's alcohol and drug program. The thing that I'm concerned about with this bill is there's really no coordination in here with the local alcohol and drug programs or mental health programs, and so I would perhaps tighten that up. I think it needs to not be just a state focus, but also a local focus. I am pleased that Representative Greenluck has put this on paper, and I think it's time that the state of Oregon and all of the local governments also take a strong look at how we are tackling our alcohol and drug programs and problems in this state. I think with the amount of funds allocated that Bob Nickel from OMAS and the governor's office have done what they can, but it is time to step up to the plate, and I think this recognizes it.
Thank you, Gina. Can I continue?
Sure. Excuse me. Vice Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tim Hartnett.
I'm the director of CODA, an alcohol and drug treatment agency in Portland. I would also tell you, just by way of the content of this bill, I'm also a former state agency head in New Hampshire, having run their division of alcohol and drug abuse. I want to first applaud Representative Greenlick for bringing this bill forward. I think it's a terrific idea. I think it's certainly needed. I won't belabor the points that others have already made. Alcohol and drug abuse is an extraordinarily cross-cutting issue. It touches all functions in state government, all aspects of state spending. I won't belabor that. The one thing I would suggest, though, I'd like to see a more ambitious bill. I'd like to see something more aggressive done. And I wanted to pass along a couple of recommendations. I think to just target drug abuse might be too limiting. I'd like to see it be a bill that coordinated alcohol and drug abuse across state agencies. I'd also like to see this person responsible for developing a statewide plan that would integrate interdiction prevention and treatment. I also think this bill ought to have some, or this position ought to have some level of budget authority or budget influence. That's the real muscle that will bring people together, bring people to the table to coordinate their efforts. I think you could probably find a language that would allow some budget authority sharing, what I would call it. I don't know what that is as I sit here now, but I sure think a person in this role ought to have that kind of authority. Another addition that, or recommendation that I would make is that the position needs to be filled by someone who has real credentials, not simply someone who's a political appointment. And if you can put that within the bill, that would be terrific. It needs to be somebody who has the gravity to bring together the interdiction, the treatment, and the prevention folks into the room to work together. I'd also suggest that we make it mandatory that department heads, not their designees, become a part of this work group. If this really is a priority, that's one surefire way to make sure that they see it as a priority as well. That's all I testify for this morning. If I can be of any help in the future on this, I'd be happy to be a part of developing this bill. I think it's one heck of an idea.
Thank you, Mr. Hartnett. Any other questions? Representative Green.
Yes, thank you. Gene, would you propose, willing to propose some amendments to try and deal with the linking of this with the local? Is there a way that we actually have the authority to do beyond directing our own executive department in this?
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlick, technically you probably don't have the authority, but I believe that putting some amendments in the bill to strengthen that relationship would be warranted, and I certainly would be willing to work with you or Tim or anybody else on amendments.
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Chair. I guess the concern that I would have would be relative then to Mr. Hartnett has indicated that it needs to go beyond the drug issue to alcohol. I'm wondering if Mr. Hartnett, while we've got Gina Furman perhaps making some potential adjustments or amendments to this drug czar, if you will, that perhaps all types of addictive substances and behavior ought to be included in that, and I wouldn't limit that to alcohol. I'd include tobacco and other kinds of addictive behaviors as well. I don't know whether that meets with Mr. Hartnett's understanding, but
I sure like the idea of including tobacco. Yeah,
it's a gateway drug.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any idea what the legislative fiscal on this would be? Ballpark? I guess I'd preface that by saying in Iowa they ended up with 10 different people. I'd have to think it's going to be $1 million easy or by any. Somewhere in
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the Department of Human Services did not assess a fiscal impact because we would work with this process. Assuming that it's in the governor's office, that's probably where the fiscal impact would come from.
And that was my second question, that how much is being spent in the governor's office that could be moved over. Do you have any idea?
Chair Dalto, Representative Anderson, I could not answer that question.
Follow-up, one final. And that is that, yes, it looks like it's coming from the state, but I would have to think, like Lipstick and some of the other organizations that are more on a local level, that the listing of people that are involved in this really would be touching base in the counties and in the cities, so there would be local tie-in, right?
Sandy, you had a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The attachment that I attached to the SMS from the Iowa, I did a web search because our committee members seem to be very interested in existing programs and this type of concept. This was the only one I could find, even though I know it's not clearly the same role as what this bill outlines. I just included it as an example of what a state is already doing, just as a little bit of information for the committee members. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Other questions or comments? No? Okay. Thanks very much. And Tom Holt.
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. I'll be very brief. Others have spoken well about the potential for this office, but I would suggest, to the extent that this person be charged with speaking with all the people concerned with drug policy, that you add to the list of people someone from the State Board of Pharmacy. They are the primary agency responsible for regulation of controlled substances and would have a fair amount of technical expertise to bring to the table on this.
How could we practice a guy named Tom?
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
I did not see Aaron Kelly Steele or Craig Campbell signed up. Are you coming forward? Are you not coming forward?
That's not Craig Campbell. He has a mohawk.
Yeah, I'm not sure we should allow him to testify in his current bald state. It's a welcome to the bald club.
Good morning. Welcome.
For a while.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell, and I am with the governor's office.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Aaron Kelly Steele. I'm the governor's health and human services policy advisor.
And by way of testimony, this particular bill opens up a good opportunity to have a good discussion about how we approach dealing with an issue as difficult as drug abuse and drug and alcohol abuse, as was raised just a moment ago. As you know, in our office, we have two and arguably three people who have responsibilities that touch on this particular area. Myself in the area of public safety, Aaron in the area of human services, and then Jim Sager in the area of education, where this also has a rather tremendous impact. What we have done, and I think it was raised earlier around, in particular, the methamphetamine issue, was we created a task force to look at that particular issue because it was one that really had very broad implications, and it really was beyond the scope of any one individual within the governor's office to try and help the governor move forward his mission, and it really required us to bring together a group of people to try and look at that. So there certainly is merit to trying to find a way to bring all the different elements together under one kind of policy oversight. Where you have some difficulty is in the sheer scope of the responsibilities that those who are in the governor's office have for oversight. Public safety, as an example, there are 9 state agencies ranging from everything from training law enforcement officers and firefighters to destroying chemical weapons. And I know that Aaron's cut off the hair, this is what happens. Aaron's responsibilities are quite as broad in dealing with human services, everything from early childhood development to drug and alcohol to senior citizens issues. So there is every potential of the need for having some way to focus the attention around drug and alcohol abuse, but at the same time, one potential concern is if that draws away from our ability to look at things in a broad scope that are beyond just drug and alcohol abuse. For instance, one thing that I can think of that's been impacting the public safety system is the mental health aspects that fold into drug and alcohol abuse.
why do people get involved in drug and alcohol abuse in the first place, and how that plays into the issue as well. So as the committee looks at this particular bill, I just encourage them to try and figure out a way to make sure that you don't exclude any of the elements that really need to be around the table in discussing the broader picture of drug and alcohol abuse, and then how to forward responses to that. Incidentally, the idea of creating a statewide plan for addressing this, I think, has a tremendous amount of potential. Of course, it will require a great amount of work and effort, and we have been taking chunks of that and creating statewide plans specifically around methamphetamine. And I know that Aaron has been working on other areas as well. So there is some precedence and some merit for doing that. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to Aaron.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, I don't have much to add except to say that I do think that, as has been raised by some of the earlier testimony, that functionally we are making every effort to coordinate and collaborate in the governor's office as well as with state agencies. I see there being several tiers of existing coordination that exists. One is inside our office. We have multiple policy advisors, and we actually do talk to each other and work together on these issues. We also then have the multiple agency efforts that come together. And there, within my area, is a specific forum of volunteer appointees to the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse, which already has been mentioned. And I did bring, and I'm sorry I didn't hand this over. Would you mind handing this to the committee assistant? Just a front and back sheet on that council's duties, and some of the duties that are highlighted for that group are also highlighted in House Bill 2955. And I work very closely with that group, with the Board of Pharmacy, and also with local government, frankly, that has quite a bit of responsibility, as you all know, for actually directly providing service. I know Craig also works closely with local government through community corrections. And so there are a myriad of coordination efforts happening already, and I think we are willing to talk about if those efforts aren't achieving the end goal, which is a statewide coordinated policy, how best to do that. Craig's raised some of the challenges, I think, that are very real for our office. We have a very small office, which I think you probably already know. And so we've approached it in the way that I've described, just with several different folks that have much broader areas that are not necessarily issue-specific that we focus on, and then we challenge ourselves to work together and coordinate. The Governor's Council does biannually do a report for our office and for the legislature, making recommendations around alcohol and drug abuse treatment and prevention policy. That report, I could also get the committee copies of if you're interested, just so you could see the effort that's been made in the past. And I think when you look at that report together with the conversation that happened around methamphetamine during the interim, you can at least see today our efforts to try to have a coordinated approach to the issue.
President Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we have these folks here from the governor's office, I'm wondering if we are going to see a concerted, consolidated effort from the governor's office relative to actually trying to get our arms around the methamphetamine problem.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we've actually been working. What you've seen is probably a small part of what we're actually engaged in doing. The recommendations that came out from the methamphetamine task force, a small portion of that required legislative action. One of the things we specifically did with the legislative recommendation is try and make recommendations that lived within what we knew would be the limited means coming through the budget. In addition to that, however, we have started to engage in a three-pronged public information campaign that I believe began last week, that targets three specific areas for prevention, those being targeting the parents of middle school kids, because we're now seeing children as young as 8 to 12, many of them second-generation methamphetamine users entering into the school. Methamphetamine is showing up at that age group. The second group would be specifically targeted at high school youth, using high schoolers to develop the messages so that they relate better. And then the third is targeting college-age and those just entering the workforce, to try and prevent them from taking advantage of what is often argued to be the benefits of methamphetamine, things like weight loss, more energy, mental acuity, and things like that, which are actually false, but that's a message that's out there. So there's the prevention side of it. Then there's the using best practices for treatment.
those tend to fall along the lines of long-term residential treatment that has, like the drug court is an example, where you're able to hold some sanction over the head of those who are going through treatment to give them incentive to continue on, but that is not just a go once a month or once a week to treatment and we assume you're going to be okay. It really has to be a much longer, much more deliberative process as best practice. Then, of course, the law enforcement side, giving them the tools to make sure that they can effectively interdict with methamphetamine, and that really means trying to break up the networks of smaller labs in the state, because that's where most of our cost drivers are. It's not where most of our supply comes from. That usually comes across the border. But as far as creating the drivers like children in meth labs, small levels or large levels of small crime, things like that, that's the law enforcement side. And then, of course, the governor's initiative to put pseudoephedrine behind the pharmacy counter. So we do have a pretty comprehensive response there.
And Chair Dalton, Representative, I may add just briefly to that, some of the ways that the meth task force work has overlapped into a broader human services perspective as well. Within child welfare, there's a strong recognition of the impact of methamphetamine. There is data from the Attorney General's office to suggest just how many, actually nearly 100% during a given period of the termination of parental rights cases they prosecuted had some methamphetamine-related element to them. Also, within our TANF program, we've been able to learn from some of the task force's work around treatment, and we know that as we work to, temporary assistance for needy families, as the department is implementing its policies around barrier removal services, services to individuals who are trying to obtain work but need treatment prior to that, we know now how that we need to, the kind of treatment that is most effective that we need to be applying for those individuals. And then lastly, in coordination with public safety's involvement in terms of pursuing and prosecuting methamphetamine users, we also have the cleanup issue, and our public health department is having to learn about how to clean up meth houses. And so there are just a myriad of ways that this overlaps both of the work that both Craig and I do. Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just respond to that by saying, without having a drug policy coordinator, I think the governor's office is doing an excellent job of attempting to coordinate. At least it appears that most of the players have been identified, but I am concerned that local government be involved, and I appreciate President Greenlech's invitation to Gina Furman to bring local governments on board, because as Aaron indicates, that's where the majority of this is getting delivered, and the Attorney General isn't going out and making the arrests. It's our local law enforcement people that are making the majority of the arrests. So I appreciate the work that is being done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Boone, and then Representative Greenlech.
I'm curious about how big a problem the meth issue is on college campuses, because from what I've seen when we've toured some of the treatment centers and what I see in my own community, the people using meth are probably not going to college.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, actually, there is no common denominator in meth abuse. It's pretty much everywhere. Now, those that you're seeing in treatment are those who have gone through meth abuse, and the truth of it is that after you become addicted to meth and you've been using it for a while, you don't care about college. You're not going to be there anymore. You're lucky if you're able to hold down a job. And your job at that point in time really becomes acquiring and sometimes producing meth. So you're exactly right. Those who you're probably seeing in treatment are not in college, although some of them may have been. What we're real concerned about there is these are people who and again, it's both college and those who are just entering the workplace. If we can divert them at that point in time because there's a lure there that later in life might not be as heavy, trying to cut it off there, we hope is going to be an effective way of really avoiding losing some of our future potential for the state. It's not the main focus of our attack, but it's part of it.
All right. Thank you. Representative Greenlech.
Thank you. I just have one question, sir. You combined most of the point people for the governor's office in this question of illegal drugs, use, interdiction, substance. But each of you have huge other tasks. I know I spend a lot of time with Aaron talking about Oregon Health Plan and long-term care and a variety of things, and I suspect you may have something else in the public safety area. I wonder if you could each estimate about how much of your energy, which I know in both your cases is 100 hours a week, is spent on on the question of illegal drugs as opposed to other areas up here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, that would be, I think it would be really challenging for me to be able to do that. I'd need to just process for a moment and maybe follow up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, of course it fluctuates. There are some times when I will be spending 10 to 20% of my time dealing particularly with methamphetamine. There will be times when most of my time during a given week will be spent during dealing with methamphetamine in specific. In other drugs in general, not nearly as much, just because we've been focusing most of our attention on methamphetamine because of the obvious rather critical level that it has created. But you are correct, there are obviously a lot of other demands that are on our time as well.
Mm-hmm. Chair Johnson, Representative Greenlake, I would say about the same, except that probably with me, because my focus on addiction and treatment is broader than just illegal drugs, but includes tobacco, alcohol, and then also gambling addiction, that it is maybe a little bit more diluted than Craig's.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you
both for being here.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2955, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3263. Sandy, do you want to introduce this bill? I'll see if Krupp can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3263 comes to you at the request of Representative Krupp. It's requesting that a person or dependent of a person who is eligible for the health insurance coverage through the person's employment ineligible for medical assistance. This does not have a prior reference, but we do not have a fiscal impact statement from fiscal year.
Thank you, Sandy. Representative Krupp, would you introduce your bill to us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. House Bill 3263 is born out of the frustrations of my wife. Well, normally her frustrations relate to me personally, but in this case, they do not. Mr. Chairman, you don't know that because you're not married, but that's okay. You'll find out. This is a very simple concept that likely is not simple in terms of its impact. The reason I brought this forward to you is that my wife has been a human resource manager for a number of years with a company that employs several hundred employees. And she's been very frustrated over the years, having seen a number of employees not place dependence on their company insurance policy and instead put them on the Oregon Health Plan. Employees who buy new vehicles, who buy homes, who could clearly afford the additional expense out of their paycheck per month to put their dependents on their company health insurance rather than at the taxpayer's expense. And the reason I brought this forward is because I think in a time when we have reduced the roles of the Oregon Health Plan, that there are people, I would bet you that in each one of your legislative districts, there are individuals who have been removed from eligibility in the Oregon Health Plan for a number of reasons, just because the money's not there. Deserving individuals, the poorest of the poor, the neediest of the needy. And to me, it is unconscionable that we allow, because we do not have, I think, tight enough or discerning enough eligibility requirements, it's unconscionably we would allow people who can afford their own health insurance, allow them to put their dependents on the Oregon Health Plan when other people that are truly needy simply can't get it. And that's the intent of this legislation. And that's my whole reason for bringing this issue up before you and having this discussion. Now, its impacts are going to be different, and I'm hopeful that people will be engaged in talking about what the potential pitfalls of this bill might be. And hopefully out of that discussion, we can talk about the positives, and we can talk about how to make this a reality, how to structure either legislation or structure the department to change their eligibility requirements to achieve the results of this bill and what the intent of this bill is. I'm not one that believes we should pass a law for everything. I think there are lots of opportunities for us as managers of the state's resources to help agencies modify their policies to achieve better results. And I don't think necessarily a law is how we achieve that. However, since it's not being done, in my opinion, unless it's been changed in terms of the eligibility requirements to remedy the circumstances that I'm aware of and that my wife has told me about for years, I brought the legislation forward to force the discussion. And I think we should have it. Again, I just think it's wrong, morally and ethically, that we would allow, through the eligibility requirements, people who can pay their own health insurance to utilize the taxpayers when deserving people can't get it. And again, that's the reason I'm here, and that's why I'd like to have you consider this.
Thank you very much, Representative Boone.
I just have a quick question, too, Representative Krupp. And I appreciate the intent. I looked at the bill and everything. What I'm concerned about is someone who might be eligible for coverage in their job, but they might not earn enough to make that payment to cover their children. So, and I don't know how you would do that if some sort of means testing or whatever, but I think I heard you sort of address that issue too.
Mr. Chair and Representative Boone, you're absolutely correct. There should be some means testing. There should be some standard that you have to meet for you to be able to be truly eligible. You have to, in my mind, you need to prove you're truly needy. And now we know we have the FEOP program is in place for the working poor, and I'm fine with that. I have long held the view, I know this sounds a bit strange, I have long held the view that the way to help people off of public welfare, as it were, is to pay them to get off of welfare. And we've typically taken the wrong approach. This is a little bit different of an idea. This is to say, prove to us that you really are deserving of assistance. Prove to us that. Because I frankly think that when you can buy a new truck, that maybe that's not your best priority. And the reason that you choose to spend your money that way is because you don't pay an extra $50 a month or $75 a month out of your paycheck to put your wife or your girlfriend and child that you've just fathered onto your company insurance plan. Because you can put them on the Oregon Health Plan, you go out and buy a new truck instead of buying perhaps a used vehicle and doing what you ought to be doing. And that's putting them on your company health plan. So I understand what you're saying. I think means testing is an appropriate direction. Will there be winners and losers out of that? Perhaps. But the people that I would suggest to you that are really losing are those people that are truly needing, that exists in our districts. They can't get the help because there just isn't enough money to go around. And until we find a better way to fix that issue, I think we have to go in these directions. Whether, again, the agency does it by rule or we do it by law.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Greenlight.
Thank you. Thanks for coming in today. There is a means test involved here, and first of all, most companies would not allow somebody to put their girlfriend on their health plan. It would have to be their wife. And the means test under, and I assume you're talking about Oregon Health Plan Standard, of which we only have 24,000 people on at the moment, is at 100% of your poverty line. Does your wife's company hire a lot of people who are full-time employees and therefore eligible for health insurance who are earn less than 100% of the poverty line?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I don't know what those...
Crap, let me help you out here. Actually, in the categorically eligible population, the Oregon Health Plan Plus, children are covered up to 185% of the federal poverty level, and I think there's more than 300,000 people in
health care. If they're in the Children's Health Insurance Plan, is that
right?
Is that what we're referring to here? I mean, I'm not sure the Children's Health Insurance Plan would be included, and there are issues in the Children's Health Insurance Plan. We're talking about medical assistance under, well, I don't have what 705 to 750 is.
Okay.
But my guess is it does include the Children's Health Insurance Plan, which is intended to help employers deal with low income children. So, I mean, if that's what we're talking about, it's designed to allow employers like Mrs. Krupp.
works for, provides children's health insurance jointly. I mean, there are ways to do that. And in fact, if they were eligible, it makes it very difficult to get into CHIP. But I think we're talking about the Oregon Health Plan Basic is what's here. And if it is, in order to be eligible, they'd have to be under 100% of the
program. Yeah, I didn't have the impression that you were limiting it to just the basic program. I thought you were limiting it to both categories, but maybe you want to clarify.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Greenlick. You know, I'll be very honest with you. I'll be quite open to any concepts or ideas that this committee can evolve around this issue as to how we achieve this result. And if it means looking at the system in a totality, that's fine. I'm willing to do that. If it means, in your judgment as a committee, knowing these issues and exploring them and working with them every day better than I do, if it means that you think that we ought to carve out an exception there, I'm willing to consider that also. I'm going to leave that up to the collective wisdom and judgment of this committee to look at this issue to determine how best to achieve this result. Again, I've tried to make it very clear what I want my result to be here. And I don't think that any of you would disagree with trying to make sure that our limited dollars extended to the most needy of the needy. It's how we get there that fundamentally I don't know precisely how to do that. But I think we need to force the conversation. And the detailed work of how that's achieved, I'm open to all ideas as to how we could make that happen.
But under the laws we have for dealing with these programs, the test isn't whether somebody's employed or not. The test is what their income is. I mean, and there is a very specific means test, and we operate under a set of federal standards that relate to what that income level is. So, I mean, we're not talking about $80,000 a year executives putting their kids on. We're talking about relatively low-income people. And my next question is, do you have any idea what it costs in your wife's company? That'd be very interesting to add on a monthly basis their family to their individual coverage, which is fully paid by the employee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, I believe that the last number she had referred me to was somewhere around 75 on up, depends on how many dependents I think are included in that. The company's policy is mandatory for all employees. They have to participate in it. Gets in, again, depending, it is a single person, I think it's around 50, no, that was a year ago. It was 50-some odd dollars out of their paycheck, and the company picked up the rest for that type of policy. In this case, it would be, I believe the minimum was $75, depending on the dependent, and it went upwards from there, depending on how many that you put on.
Our state employee program, as I remember the last number I heard, adding a family to the individual coverage was something in the neighborhood of $400 a month. But we could check that in terms of state employee, which in terms of somebody who makes, say, $800 a month or $1,000 a month, that's a pretty huge chunk. I mean, we live in a free economy, and we want people to make what's a rational economic choice for them. In this case, it's an issue, but it would be useful for us to see what that family coverage is in a variety of kind of organizations around the state.
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, the only thing I would say in response to your comment is that the state pays our health insurance in totality. In this circumstance, the employer pays the bulk of it. The employee makes a smaller contribution. So those numbers would be commensurate with those divisions of payment responsibility.
It does for representatives, but not necessarily for all state employees. Capable family coverage.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Next, we have Barney Spate with OMAP.
Absolutely. That's what I think. Yeah, that's a good way to do it.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Barney Spade, Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Program within the Department of Human Services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3263. My testimony is in written format and it's being distributed. I will try to be brief and leave room for questions. The department is opposed to House Bill 3263 primarily because of federal regulations that if this bill were to become law in its current form, would place us in direct contravention with the federal Medicaid regulation, which does, as a condition of receiving federal matching funds for the Medicaid program, require states to provide medical assistance regardless of health insurance coverage by a third party, such as an employer-sponsored health plan. And I note in my testimony that federal financial participation in our medical program is substantial. As part of the due diligence in looking at this bill, we did inquire with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, commonly referred to as CMS, about the feasibility of such a state waiver. And there is, interestingly, one state who has a waiver in this regard, and it's the state of Hawaii. And it was waived as part of the Hawaii reforms of the 70s that required employer insurance mandates with specified minimum levels of coverage. And Hawaii is unique, as my testimony notes, because its reforms were put in place as the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, also known as ERISA, was being enacted, and Hawaii was exempted through that legislation from certain parts of ERISA relating to health insurance. We feel that for categorical eligibility folks in Medicaid, it's highly unlikely that CMS would offer another state a waiver. I do point out, and I am pleased that Representative Krupp indicated that Oregon did enact the Oregon Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, FEOP, I believe it was in the 1997 legislature, to offer an alternative to low-income working families and individuals, an alternative to the Oregon Health Plan or Medicaid medical assistance. And that's primarily to assist on a sliding scale basis with premiums in either group coverage or in employer in individual coverage if the person doesn't have group coverage. And I know that Rocky King and his staff would be more than willing to make more information to the committee available on that. I would also note that we do have a program in which if an applicant does have employer-based coverage, we do review at the eligibility level to determine if it's cost-effective for the state to pay the premium for that employer-based coverage, and then Medicaid becomes a wraparound or secondary coverage with the employer-based coverage being primary. We would be picking up primarily premium cost sharing and benefits that were not covered. I don't have with me this morning the number of people that are participating in that, but I can get that to the committee. So there is an effort on the part of the agency to look at where there is employer-based coverage of is there a cost-effective means to keep that coverage in place. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay. I think we'll keep questions for another time. Thanks very much, Barney.
Okay.
Appreciate it. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3263 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2692. Sandy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2692 is establishing a personal income tax credit for earned income that is foregone in order to donate or receive a kidney, partial liver, or whole liver, a pancreas, or a lung. It limits the credit to 50% of the foregone earned income. It directs the Department of Revenue to design an individual income tax return form with a charitable checkoff box for the Organ Transplant Support Fund. This has a subsequent referral to Revenue Committee.
Okay, Chris Chapman. Good morning, welcome.
Good morning.
Chair Dalto. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Chris Chapman. I live in Portland, Oregon. And I also work as a legislative aide to Representative Steve March. Thank you so much for having this hearing. I'm so happy. I do have amendments to the bill. I thought that the methodology for determining the amount of the credit given to a person was pretty cumbersome. And I copied off some other states that have similar legislation. So we're now talking about, or I'd like to talk about, just taking $10,000 off the top of their income for the year. And that is something other states have done. I'm sitting around. I've got amendments here, and there's also a packet with some press articles about the other states and what they've done. Basically, I'd be copying Wisconsin, who started this this with the $10,000 off the top of the income. The other thing I should say to clarify is it's up to $10,000 deduction off of your gross income for the year. What they are asking folks to do is do this in an itemized way. I just assume we took $10,000 off the top, personally. I don't think that cost to the state is that great. That's the simplest way to do it, and I would love to see us do that. So, I did have a couple of things I wanted to say. I am a kidney donor. That's why I'm doing this. There are a number of hurdles that one has to undergo while one's going through the process, and my idea was to make this as easy on both donors and recipients as we possibly could. The thing that's easy for a state to do is to do stuff regarding the tax structure, so that's why I went with this. My idea really is simply to do something nice for donors and recipients. I'm trying to make this the easiest way we can do it. And also, if I may say, and this is said in this building quite a lot, but if there's a nonpartisan issue, to me, this is it. It doesn't matter if someone is a D or an R. What matters is whether or not their blood type to match a kidney or other organ. That's what really matters. In the little packets that I handed out, there's an article from Wisconsin, which was the first state to pass similar legislation. There's an article from Arkansas. In Arkansas, the legislation was sponsored by 88 out of 100 legislators. And there's a real good reason for that, and that is that two of the legislators are kidney donors themselves. One gentleman donated a kidney to his son. The other woman donated a kidney to her sister. In this body, former Senator Bill Fisher was given a kidney by his daughter Laura Fisher earlier this year. The other thing I wanted to say is that there are 15 other states with similar legislation this year. So I do feel that there's some momentum going on this. I would love to see Oregon join the list of states that are doing this kind of thing. I'm not at all married to how it's done. I only want to see something done for donors and recipients. I'd be glad to answer any questions y'all have.
What did your Dash 1 amendment accomplish?
It was a when they wrote the bill, they were talking about earned tax credit for half of the period of recovery. My amendments were to take out that cumbersome way mode of funding and just say, let's take $10,000 off their gross income at the start of their tax preparation for the year in question. So to me, it was simplifying the whole kind of muddied up process of the money with it. The other thing I did this time in terms of the money is I put down for a funding source to have a charitable tax donation added to the tax return form.
Okay. Representative Butler, a quick question because we have
certainly. I noticed that both in Wisconsin and in Arkansas, it limits the deduction to certain expenses.
Yes.
And you're proposing that it not be limited to any expenses?
Yes, sir. That is correct.
$10,000 straight.
Correct. The other thing that also says is that is for people who itemize, and not everyone itemizes. And I don't see the need to make people list that kind of expense. If they're on the list, if they either got an organ or gave an organ, I think we should be okay with taking $10,000 off the top for them. That is my ultimate goal, what I would like. I would be willing to settle for anything less than that. I mean, if you guys want to just do expenses, great.
I'd rather ask for the world. I'd rather ask for the most and scale back as I need to.
Okay. Representative Cameron.
Just to clarify, maybe to Representative Butler, being our resident CPA on the committee, a $10,000 income credit is basically in Oregon a $900 tax saving. Would that be correct?
This
at a 9%.
Yeah, what's happening is that it would make it outside of the medical expenses that they may already incur. So this is on top. The request is on top of that. So it, basically, it would be for Oregon a separate adjustment, which would be a very significant tax break.
$900.
$900 on the Oregon individual income taxes. But the request is. The request is above the line in addition to itemization, so that would give everyone, and there's not a lot of people that are involved, obviously, too. That'd be one of the questions. How many Oregonians are involved? And Chris just introduced one whole separate additional item, and that was this was both for the beneficiaries and the recipients, mm-hmm. what you just said.
Yes, sir.
So that's twice as many people that are involved as normally.
The figures I have from Wisconsin are 213 in Wisconsin, so I think we can look at roughly 200 people at least for the first couple of years. The other thing I wanted to just clarify, Representative Butler, I'm not sure if you were under this impression or not, but the medical expenses for the donor and the recipient are paid by Medicaid. These are the associated expenses of travel and lodging, but generally speaking, the donor and the recipient do not have medical expenses to take care of.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to point out, colleagues, that apparently our new Pope is a potential organ donor.
I'm sorry? Yes. Yes, I included that because I thought it was very interesting. The article is from 5 years ago, but yes, when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, I hope I didn't pronounce that miscorrectly, he signed up. In Europe, they have, it's a different setup. You have to specify if you don't want to donate your organs upon your demise. And so not only is the new Pope didn't opt out of that system, but he also joined the registry that says, please take any and all organs that could help other people in the event I'm in an accident. So I included that just to give you guys more information about this. I really do think this is a great thing. There's also a quote in, I believe it's the Arkansas article that says that if there was ever a reason to cut back on the amount of funding brought into the state, that this would be the reason to do it. And there's also a bioethicist quoted in the Wisconsin article that says that with the use of a tax deferment, there are safeguards in place to guard against, let's just say, you know, people doing what they shouldn't do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks very much, Chris.
Thank you.
With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2692. Open House here at public hearing on House Bill 2999. This is the bill that increases from 12 to 16 the maximum number of children allowed to be cared for in a certified family child care home. We have one person on the list, Rosetta Wanger. And Rosetta, are you still here? Okay. I've talked with Representative Debbie Farr from Eugene about this prior. It sounds like a good bill that's mostly housekeeping. So could you just give us a short run through of why it's a good bill?
Yes, I have written testimony. Most importantly, this came about because of community forums and in the rural area
Spill your name, please.
I'm Rosetta Wangren. Thank you. I'm Rosetta Wangren. I am the chair of the Oregon Commission for Child Care. And we do community forums around the state. And last year we were in Pendleton and we heard a large community concern about having enough child care for people to maintain work in that community. And so out of that was formed a work group that looked at a number of possibilities. And the best and final possibility was to change the number of children that certified family homes could take. Currently, the number is 12, and raise that to 16. I want to be sure that everyone understands that this doesn't change current ruling around city ordinances or the number of providers that would have to be available to meet the child-to-adult ratio. The commission also did a community forum in Bend just this last week, and we heard from that community a very large support for what House Bill 3999 was attempting to do. And I have attached an email that I asked the provider to send me in that from that community. She's been a provider there for 15 years, and so you can read what she has to say. I think that she has said it very well, that it is not cost-effective for her to take in 12 children because she would have to hire another person, and those additional two children do not offset the cost. But if we raise that number to 16, she can bring in another adult. It will be feasible for her to hire another staff, and that actually gives a better ratio for that child. It will be 1-to-8 ratio with two adults versus the 1-to-10 ratio that she currently has. Also, you have a letter from one of the commission members who happens to be an attorney in the Bend area who explains from a business sense the value of this bill. And with that, I will stop and thank you for your patience with me. Since this is the first time I've ever testified, I apologize for not recognizing Mr. Chair and other committee members. And if you have any questions for me that I can answer, also Tom Olson from the Child Care Division is here today. If there's any questions that I can't answer, he might be able to.
Well, you testified like a pro. I mean, I wish everybody could be as concise as you. So I think we're in good shape. Doesn't seem to me like there's any opposition to this bill. Doesn't seem to me like the agency is objecting. Sounds like a good business model. Sounds like the kids get good care. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And if you should have any questions in the future, please feel free to contact me. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2999 and open a work session on House Bill 2999. Can I have a motion, please?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2999 to the full House to do pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2999 to the House floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? I'll ask the clerk to call the roll, please.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Vice Chair Clement.
Yeah,
aye. Vice
Chair
Butler.
Aye.
Chair Dalton.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2999, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Can I have a motion for the consent calendar, please?
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2999. The consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? House Bill 2999 is ordered to place on the consent calendar. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2999. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2588. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee will recall House Bill 2588. We heard the end of March 28th to be exact. It directs the Oregon Health and Science University to conduct a research project to investigate the impact of allowing open access to chiropractic services and worker compensation claims. You may recall right now the restrictions on the chiropractors are that they can have 12 visits or 30 days, and then the injured worker needs to go back to the primary care physician and be reassessed to go back to the chiropractors. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. You do have a hand engrossed version of the bill. The dash ones are included in that hand engrossed, and those amendments were submitted by Dr. Vern Sabo.
Okay, thanks very much, Sandy. Dr. Sabo, can I ask you to come forward, please? Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
So, Dr. Sabo, I'd like to move this bill at some point. Are we ready?
Yes.
Okay. I think you need to introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Vern Sabo. I am the current representative of the Chiropractic Association of Oregon.
Okay, Dr. Sabo. So can you explain to us where you are in your work to try to gain everybody's input on this bill?
Well, the most recent work was a stakeholders meeting we had approximately 2 weeks ago that addressed concerns and suggestions by the stakeholders, and those amendments, dash one amendments that you have in front of you, are the result of those agreements.
Okay. Maybe we'll stand at ease for a moment.
Yeah.
Thanks. That we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2588. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2588. Have we adopted the dash ones yet?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Chair, before we move, I need to clear a potential conflict of interest on this. I have no financial relationship with this project, but I've been an informal consultant to it, and I think, therefore, it's important to put that on the record.
Spiritual advisor to the stars?
Spiritual.
Okay.
But my Ouija board.
Chair, I move the dash one amendments dated 4/12/05 be appended to House Bill 2588.
Thank you very much, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2588. Is there any objection? Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll, I guess.
Representative Anderson. Aye. Representative Coons. Aye. Representative Cameron. Aye. Representative Greenland. Aye. Representative, or Vice Chair Tomei. Aye. Vice Chair Butler. Aye. Chair Belker. The chair votes aye.
The amendments are adopted. Representative Butler?
I move House Bill 2588 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2588 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative
Boone. Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Tomei.
Aye.
Vice Chair Butler.
Aye.
Chair Dalton.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2588, having received a constitutional majority, is referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2588. And do we want to give Representative Hansen a ring to see if he wants to come down and testify on his bill?
Mr. Chairman, I do believe he's in Ways and Means, so he should be in hearing with ease.
Okay. We'll stand at ease for just a moment. Don't go anywhere, please, colleagues.